My name's Dan Kaminsky. This is my first time out here in Germany, out here in Berlin, and I have to say I've had a fantastic time. So thank you, everyone. So what am I here today to do? I am here to talk to you about DNS, the often ignored but universally used system at the heart of pretty much every internet connection out there. Why do I have what looks like a Winamp screensaver on my screen? Well, because sitting around with a random PowerPoint slides didn't seem too fun, and there's a lot of name servers out there. I mean a lot. Like, every single dot on there is a name server. There are over 150,000 name servers on the 64.IP range alone. Most recent estimates I've seen have been around 2 to 3 million on the entire public internet. I have to admit I was a little too lazy to scan the entire range myself. But yeah, so there's a lot of these boxes out there, and there are actually some significant security concerns involving them. So that's actually what we'll be discussing today. All right. Who am I? Well, I work for Avaya, and they, you know, used to be Lucent, used to be AT&T, make big old phone stuff. I'm an author of a set of tools called the Paketo Kiyotsu. They're in a collection of advanced TCP/IP manipulation utilities. Probably the most useful among them being ScanRand, which deals with high-speed scanning of TCP services across the entire internet, both discovering services and discovering the routes involved. I'm a common speaker at a series of talks called the Black Hat Briefings. I've given talks about, obviously, TCP/IP, as well as a decent amount of stuff involving SSH, which has come in quite handy while messing with DNS. Long story short, I'm a protocol geek. Subject of our investigation. We are here today to talk about DNS, the domain name system created by Paul Makapetris in 1983. This system is ancient, but dear God, does it actually work? It is a fast, easy, and accurate way to, given a host name, find out its number. The internet doesn't run on names any more than the phone network does. In fact, the internet changes its numbers a heck of a lot more commonly than the phone network does. You know, we might have our phone numbers for years. You know, there's been the same phone number going to my mom's house for the past 30 or so years. Okay, none of us are going to have our present IP addresses in 30 years, I hope. And so therefore, because of that, the internet's equivalent of a 411 directory service, 411's what we have in the States, no one actually remembers IP numbers. Everyone remembers the name, and on demand, they go ahead and they look up the number associated with it. Now, they will store the number for a little period of time in what's called DNS caching. But it's a matter of seconds, you know, maybe a day's worth. At absolute maximum, 1 week. You're certainly not going to hold the same IP address or IP number for 30 years. The question... is it possible for DNS to do anything more interesting than return numbers from names? Well, the simple answer is, well, yes, of course. DNS has all sorts of interesting functionality. We can do mail servers and names. We can go the other direction, like reverse lookup, names from numbers. We can get SPF records, try to, you know, make an attempt to deal with spam. I didn't say it worked, but it was an attempt. Better answer. Why do you ask? Well, DNS is very old. I mean, it's the second oldest, what I call, uncontested protocol for what it does. You know, guys, Telnet's pretty much getting wiped out by SSH, and Gopher and FTP are pretty much moving over to HTTP at this point. The only other protocol that's actually lasted nearly as long as DNS has been SMTP for mail sending. DNS is globally deployed. It's universally employed. It's the one protocol I can safely say every single person in this room uses on a daily basis. And interestingly enough, first of all, routes everywhere. You know, there are lots of networks you can't get mail out from, or you can't even sometimes get web out from, but you can always look up a name. Interestingly enough, DNS was heavily used during the recent the Blasterworm. You know, this was a great worm. They go ahead, they get a worm, they get it on hundreds of thousands of machines, and they're going to go ahead and flood WindowsUpdate.com. Boy, it'd be nice if that was the address of Windows Update. The actual address is WindowsUpdate.microsoft.com. But you have hundreds of thousands of machines all looking up WindowsUpdate.com, which is some random squatter somewhere. And I had people coming to me and saying, Dan, how are we going to find all the Blaster-infected nodes? I'm like, why don't you just look at the DNS records? And I tell you, the reaction I got was, you can do that? I'm like, yes, sniffers are not a new technology. No one looks at DNS traffic. Not even when you've got this huge flood, not even when you've got hundreds of thousands of machines broadcasting out messages saying, hi, I've been infected. Why don't you look here? no one looks. So, why am I saying, can we, you know, do anything more with DNS? Well, because no one's looking at it. No one's paying attention. It works for all sorts of things. And by the way, when we pay attention to it, we find nasty worms. This is a whole good reason to go ahead and look at DNS further. So the strategy for analysis is going to be, does DNS have any unexpected similarities, or use the snooty word homologies, to other protocols that I consider interesting? Having worked in SSH, I like tunneling. So what can we tunnel over DNS? Well, this is totally expected, very well known. DNS servers can carry arbitrary data. It's not just English host names and IP addresses. DNS, basically, it moves bits. Bits can, you know, within various horribly onerous constraints, can be anything. Now, there are lots of constraints we got to live with. In general, the total packet size has to be less than 512 bytes. Our downstream is, you know, there's lots of limitations. But within all these limitations, we actually have some flexibility. When trying to get data out from the internet into ourselves, we can use what's called a text record. Text records are absolutely hated by people who love DNS, and therefore they're totally loved by me, because they basically explicitly allow arbitrary, unstructured content to simply be shoved into place. And to give you a demonstration of what it looks like, when I look up that address, or mostly, that doesn't work because you guys would mess with it during my talk. But yeah, that huge batch of characters up there actually is what I'm getting back out of DNS. Now, that turns out to give me about 220 bytes of arbitrary data down per packet. Now, granted, this is about a 500-byte packet, so our efficiency sucks, but I'll live. How do we send data from ourselves back onto the internet? And again, this has been done before, but I'm just telling you guys how it's done. The name of the host that you look up it has to be less than 253 characters. It has to have less than 64 characters between the dots. There are only 63 valid characters. Why would this be incredibly annoying to have 63? Well, because 2 to the 6 is 64. We could have 6 bits of data per character if that had 64 valid characters. But we don't. We have 63 valid characters, so we have to fit everything into 2 to the 2 to the 5. We can only use 5 out of 8 bits in what's called base 32 encoding. And when we go ahead and we have names to look up, say, you know, that huge mass right there, O-R-U-G-S, blah, 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 dot, you know, bunch of docsparrow.com. That is what you can send up from yourself in such a way that it will traverse the DNS network. Now, when I said there's a capacity for 512 bits or 512 bytes in a DNS packet, this can sort of be waived. Through the miracle of DNSSEC, we actually have what's called the EDNS0 field. It's an optional field and allows you to say, yeah, previous versions of DNS may only have liked 512 byte packets, but we're going to allow more, much more, arbitrarily sized more, maybe even more than IP can handle. We'll let IP fragment it out. And that way you can have all these signatures and detailed cryptographic data, and it still fits inside of DNS. Quite nice. Using this, we can actually increase our capacity from 220 bytes down all the way up to a kilobyte down per DNS packet. How nice is that? And it looks kind of like this. Sorry for the screenshot, but I did get this in about, 40 minutes ago? Yeah, so we do a DNS request, and we get this huge, huge amount of text data back. Much nicer, much, much more efficient. One of the things you'll find when you're doing evil things to DNS servers is they kind of don't like massive numbers of packets per second. This is a very nice way of getting around the massive numbers of packets per second. You actually shove more data into the packet. So, unexpected homologies inside a DNS. First of all, DNS servers can be thought of as proxy servers. Now, you always know you log onto a network, it gives you a DNS server that if you ask it stuff, say, hey, give me the address for Google. Well, it'll go ahead and get you the address for Google. And if it doesn't know the address for Google already, it'll go out and get it for you. This is just like when you're talking to a web proxy. Hey, why don't you get me the web page for Google? It doesn't know it. It goes out to Google and it gets it for you. And shockingly enough, when it gets it for you once, maybe it'll store it around for the next idiot who goes to Google. So hey, just like Squid goes ahead and stores caches of web pages, DNS servers store caches of the addresses that got you to the web pages in the first place. It's actually quite convenient. But it turns out DNS does more. DNS is also a routing protocol. Now, how many people here are familiar with the concept of the DNS hierarchy? Not too bad. I'm impressed. DNS is set up in a hierarchical formation. In other words, there are, was it 13, 20? There's some number of root servers out there who have information about pretty much every major second level name on the entire internet. Every major name. So every name. So docspara.com, cnn.com, google.com, all sorts of information. Now, they don't know everything. They don't know every site that's at docspara.com because, you know, I have lots and lots and lots of sites, and we're not going to shove that into this massive uber centralized database. No. What happens is when you go to these root servers, they tell you, okay, you know what? I don't know everything about this guy, but why don't you go over to this host? He'll tell you more. This is the route you should take to get more information. So what that means is that there's actually a routing protocol for data built into DNS. We can go ahead and when we're communicating with hosts, we can say, oh, you want some information? Why don't you ask this guy over here? This guy over here. Oh, you want some information? Why don't you ask this guy over here? You could actually set up arbitrary depth routing trees inside of DNS. And this is going to turn out really useful later. So, in summary, we can move arbitrary data. We can bounce it off arbitrary servers. We got like 150,000 on 64. Alone. We can route it in arbitrary ways. And oh yeah, then we have caches. So we can store data on a hop-by-hop basis. That's pretty cool. The end result is that we can say DNS, it's a globally deployed routing, caching, overlay network running astride the entire public, and private internet. You know, this is kind of interesting. These are terms we would normally use to talk about peer-to-peer networks, about some blissful future where we have millions of nodes that are all exchanging data. Guess what? We've got it now, and it's called DNS. So, what's our weapon of choice? Since, you know, just talking about cool stuff isn't enough, it's nice to actually do it every once in a while. I've written a toolkit. It's called Aussie Man DNS. Look ye mighty upon my packets in despair. It is a toolkit for advanced DNS investigation. It's built using Perl's NetDNS library. Has anyone here actually used NetDNS? Okay, this thing is beautiful. Say what you will about it being slow or fast. It's gotten a lot faster. This is the only library I've ever seen. It was good enough to make me learn the language. I did not like Perl. And then I saw NetDNS, and I'm like, okay, I better start liking Perl right now if I ever want to get this stuff done. It's really mature. It's really flexible. It reads packets. It breaks them. It modifies them. It sends them back out. And it does so in a way that integrates well with the rest of the language. This is unheard of when it comes to DNS. If you actually start dealing with DNS packets by hand, you will probably want to throw yourself off a cliff. They get very, very tricky. Implements many of the concepts we're discussing today. We have a server. It's called Namday. This is, you know, instead of Namd, it's Namday, as in Gare. It's an experimental name server. And the clients, well, you'll see about the clients. DNS tunneling. Is it possible to achieve useful network connectivity out from even extraordinarily egress-filtered networks? Now, what would be the most common egress? You guys know what egress filtering is? That means you try to send a net packet out and the network laughs at you. That's egress filtering in a nutshell. What is the most common networks that laugh at you when you try to send packets out? There's a decent number of these what's called captive portals in the wireless world. You know, they want you to spend some absurd amount of money. Or, you know, they want you to be a student at their university. Or they actually want to be someplace that restricts, you know, there's actually a decent number of companies that restrict outbound connectivity. They want you to go through their web portals, you know. Any way you want to shake it, there's a decent number of networks that are actually very tricky to get data out of. Yet, pretty much all of these networks all allow DNS to escape pretty much entirely unmolested. Usually, though, there's some restrictions. You're only able to talk to the local name server. You can't just talk to any name server in the world. And because you have to talk to the local name server, and it has to proxy for you, because, like I told you guys, DNS servers are proxy servers. You have to be entirely compliant with the way that DNS works. You can't just send arbitrary size packets. You have to talk in the correct language. But you know what? We can do that. It's not too hard. What makes it interesting? It routes everywhere, out of every network, escapes most form of egress restriction. Nobody's looking at it, so you don't need to worry about sniffers because no one's paying attention. Anyone wonder why no one pays much attention to DNS? So it's at the core of a lot of protocols, right? What happens when you mess with a system that is depended on at the core of lots of protocols? Lots of things break. This breaking is so painful and so horrifying, no one looks at DNS. Because every time they try to firewall this stuff, some obscure service breaks. It's so weird and so unexpected for these services to break, DNS has gotten away with murder. So yeah, DNS was not designed to tunnel arbitrary network connectivity. So this makes it a pretty broken network to start with. And I like that, because I like playing with broken networks. I am not the first person. I do not claim to be the first person to tunnel arbitrary traffic over DNS. The most popular toolkit for doing DNS tunneling is what's called NSTX. It is very nice. It creates what's called a virtual network device that routes IP, actually Ethernet frames, over DNS. It is a Linux-only solution. It has been around for several years. It is quite excellent, but it's limited to Linux, and it's not exactly trivial to set up. There are also rumors, and I mean rumors as in it's happening. There's a decent number of botnets out there that have figured out, hey, you know, if we just send all the traffic we want to send over DNS, gee, we'll have much, much better penetration of our data back to wherever we're trying to talk to. Why? Because IRC doesn't get out of every network. DNS does. So I have another approach to tunneling. NSTX requires kernel cooperation. Why? Because NSTX is moving IP packets, and user space does not have access to IP packets. I'd like to make something that doesn't require the kernel, but I still want to be able to route all my traffic remotely, you know, access the internet as if I wasn't behind a massively egress-filtered network. How can I do this? Well, normally we do something with VPNs. You know, you VPN all your traffic. It's just like NSTX. They pick up your IP. But wait, we already said we can't do that. So what are we going to do? A few years back, I started working on some code for SSH. And it's actually been in there for years now. It's called dynamic forwarding. Dynamic forwarding allows you to basically, I call it a poor man's VPN. Any host you can SSH into, you can actually set up tunnels that allow arbitrary network connectivity. Now, anyone who's used SSH knows you can go ahead and use this dash L option, be able to say, I want my local mail server to be on local on port 25, and I want my, you know, IMAP server to be on port 143. Well, you need to normally pre-declare all of your associations between what shows up on your local host and what it's actually supposed to be way out there in the outside world. Well, this doesn't work well at all for stuff like web browsing or instant messaging or a bunch of other things. So I created something called dynamic forwarding. It uses a protocol called SOX, which is, you know, pretty much all over the place. And it allows SOX to tell your SSH client on a per socket basis, okay, I'm connecting to you locally now, but I'd actually like you to connect me to Yahoo. I'd actually like you to connect me to MSN. It's a very quick and very elegant way. It's the SSH-D option for if you can make an SSH connection out to a remote host, you can get arbitrary remote networking. So, if we can get SSH over DNS to work, we can get arbitrary remote networking over DNS. Very nice. Oh, and because it's SSH, it's all encrypted and secure and no one can sniff. Sweet. All right. So this should be easy, right? Oh, God, no. Oh, God. NSDX had something that was nice. You know, IP packets don't expect to actually get there. IP stacks handle the fact that packets get dropped, or more accurately, they shove it up to another layer. They let TCP handle all the dropped packets. DNS is not TCP. TCP moves byte streams. You can just shove out bytes and they'll get there and, you know, maybe they'll get packetized, but you don't really care about that. You shove bytes here and they come out there and that's all you know. Okay, DNS isn't like that. DNS, you have records. You have, you know, this is a chunk of data, it goes there. Hey, look, we have a chunk of data from over there, it comes back. Packets are very record-oriented. TCP lets either side speak first. Anyone can say, hey, I've got some information for you. Oh, not DNS. No, with DNS, the server is only allowed to speak to you if you ask it a question first. Now, it's true, the server could send a response back, but you probably won't get it because the proxy server is going to be like, hey, look, I've got a packet here. No one asked for it. Drop. So DNS is client-server. TCP is 8-bit clean. You can shove whatever bytes you want in there, and it's not going to die. Oh, not DNS. DNS was intended for human-readable data, so DNS like has a heart attack on you. You can basically only move a limited set of data in each direction. Downstream, you can only do base 64 characters. It's like A through Z, a couple numbers, and a little bit of punctuation. Upstream, you have A through Z. Oh, and you caps aren't actually supposed to be enforced. So you have like A through Z, not uppercase, and some numbers and, you know, whatever else you want. But yeah, it's pretty broken. It's pretty sad. So these are our constraints. These are our restrictions that we have to follow if we want to be protocol compliant. And we do. Because by being protocol compliant, we get to traverse the entire DNS network, live with the proxies, you know, not crash anything, which isn't what I'm trying to do. These limitations are very familiar. These limitations are exactly what we have for HTTP. And let me tell you, people have been making a really big deal out of tunneling arbitrary data over HTTP. Anyone hear of what's it called? Web services? This genius idea, we can do RPC over the internet? Really? Holy crap. But it's all secure because it's RPC over the internet, but it's in HTTP. And the web is magic. And nothing ever gets hacked over the web. So HTTP is pretty much exactly like DNS, with an exception. HTTP packets can basically HTTP messages can be arbitrary size, and DNS it can't be. DNS is very good at moving almost power of two amounts of data. 110 bytes is not 128. 220 bytes, not 256. I swear it's just like that to annoy me. Now, many, many, many tools have been written with a let's tunnel everything over HTTP methodology. I mean, all of SOAP, all of web services, all of XML RPC, and of course, GNU HTTP tunnel. So at one point, I was going to go ahead and take HTTP tunnel and port it to DNS. And that was before I realized that was a really bad idea. So I ended up writing my own system. It's called DRoute. It is a DNS stream router. If you're expecting a demo in about 10 seconds, you're totally going to get one. But let's talk about how it works first. Our different directions have totally different semantics, so they're actually very separated out. Now, as I said, TCP is a byte stream protocol. SSH expects to be able to go over TCP. It expects to be able to have a byte stream. So we are going to treat the data coming from SSH one way, and we're going to treat the data going to SSH the other. The data from SSH going from client to server, this can send at any possible time. So no problem. We just go ahead. We take 110 byte chunks of the data, or whatever happens to be available at this chunk of time. We encode it into a name that is being looked up. That name is encoded in base 32, is sent straight up. No problem. Downstream's a little more complicated. We basically have to sit around polling. Hey, do you have any data for me yet? How about now? Got any data? This would be problematic if we were always polling at max frequency. So we have a simple protocol. If there's no data, we wait three times longer until we ask again. And we wait longer and longer until some maximum. This ends to work pretty well. And of course, the data we're bringing down is through the text records I showed you earlier. The two streams are kept totally separate. They could theoretically be unified, but it ended up being easier not to. And this works, and works well. Now, the present implementation is what I call single-threaded. That means there's only one packet in flight at any given time. This makes things ungodly slower than they otherwise should be. I am quite embarrassed, but I do not have a multi-packet implementation that is ready yet. I will, however, give you a demo of what that looks like as well. But first of all, let's show some SSH over DNS, because, how readable is that? Not so much. You guys know about RxVT for SigWin, by the way? It's about the only way to make serious work on Windows palatable. And at this point, I'm beyond operating systems, but I actually want a working shell, thank you very much. So let's see, that's 18. Yeah, so basically you get SigWin is a Unix-style environment that runs on Windows, and RxVT actually gives you a real shell. And it's actually in the standard distribution. It's very nice. Yeah, it's close enough. See, I actually care about you guys being able to see what I do. All right. All right, everyone can see this, right? As you can see, I am very messy about the number of files I mess with. So. So, here's what's going to happen. That's a radio demo. Oh, yeah, we're going to have DNS radio later, but that's not what we're doing now. All right, here's what we're going to do. And I actually haven't tested this particular command, so we may have to change it lightly. So, we're going to run SSH. We're going to activate compression. We're going to have the dash V option because it's going to be really slow, and you guys have to see something to know it actually works. Port forwarding is going to be on, the dynamic forwarding. We're going to use something called a proxy command. Now, lots and lots of people wanted SSH to support their own custom little proxying solutions. And eventually the solution became, hey, you write your tool, you do this, and give us a TCP socket. Or give us even standard I.O. And we'll talk to it. So this way we don't need to support whatever messed up protocol you have. Here, you do the work, give us standard I.O., and we're happy. So, Droute gives you standard I.O. out of DNS TCP. Let's run it. This may work. Bueller. There we are. So, as you can see, we are slowly getting through the various phases of the SSH communication setup. This is all going over DNS. Hey, look, we have shell. Now, I mean... shell rocks, but it turns out there is one service that actually works totally perfectly over this whole setup. Indeed. I love game, even when it doesn't entirely work. So we see SSH saying it's doing all sorts of proxying for us, which it is. And hey, what do we have here? Any minute now. Hey, it's all the buddies. Hey, Chica, CCC says hi.
Over DNS.
I'll tell her she's on stage later. So, this is useful. It turns out that of all the communication mechanisms, IM is the least latency sensitive thing in the world. You really don't care that, oh, it took an extra 2 whole seconds for my data to get there. Who cares? So, that works well. Woot. That's how you get out of egress filter networks. Then there's the opposite, the ingress filter networks. And this is where we actually get into some actual genuine security problems. Can we break into networks using DNS? And worryingly enough, the answer is yes. Alice. Anyone here play with crypto? Know about the whole Alice and Bob fetish? Well, yeah, we're going to continue that. In this case, Alice is our requester, you know, idiot with a client. Bob is the DNS server. Alice wears 2 hats. Alice is the requester. Alice can say, hey, I'd like to know where foo.com is. Can you go out and find out? And Bob goes, crap, Alice wants more from me. Okay, fine. Okay, go to the, you know, hierarchy, figure out where foo.com is, and foo.com is, it's right back at Alice. Now it's Alice being the responder. Oh, you're looking for foo.com, says Alice. Oh, that would be at 1.2.3.4. Alice can both initiate queries and be the source of the answers. Now, as the source of the answers, Alice can do more than just request stuff. Alice can go ahead and manipulate the very same routing commands that brought Bob to her in the first place. Bob got a message from the hierarchy that said, hey, go to this IP address. It will tell you more. Alice can give an answer if she wants, but she can also say, go to this IP address. It can give you more. And you can get about 16 to 32 levels of redirection before Bob's just like, you're jerking me around. I die. Now, DNS trusts the hierarchy to tell it where to route to next. And the hierarchy is public. Goes back to Alice. Says, hey, Alice, where's foo.com? Alice says, you know, I wish I could tell you, but I don't know. But why don't you ask this IP address 10.0.1.10? A lot of DNS servers out there are multi-hosted, meaning they're talking both to the outside world and to hosts on the internal network. They have 2 interfaces. You go ahead and you tell Bob, hey, you, why don't you go to this IP address and, oh, is that IP address on your internal interface? Guess what? It works. Because Bob's a DNS servers are proxy servers. There's 2 million proxy servers out there, a decent portion of them which are dual hosted. They're dual hosted. You tell them, pass it on internally. Whenever Alice is a responder, Alice can go ahead and say, please pass this data inside. Now, that being said, there are limits. Only DNS data can be so proxied. You can't just be like, hey, I've got, you know, some SSH traffic. Oh, wait, it can be SSH over DNS traffic. That works great. So you'd basically need some piece of custom internal malware that already got into a network. But assuming it got into the network, and mind you, you can scan for your malware, this code inside the network doesn't need to poll anymore. It just sits there waiting for traffic from the corporate DNS server. And this traffic comes in, the commands happen, and whatever nastiness occurs. This is basically why I'm advising people, please, for the love of God, will you start monitoring your DNS traffic? Because there are a lot of these dual-hosted servers. In general, there's lots of situations where traffic on the DNS server can get back inside. Now there's a way to actually route the packets, and it's a problem. And incidentally, there's potential for attacks against DNS servers that do an extraordinary amount of extension against, we'll skip that for now. Mainly because I like to warn companies about that kind of stuff. Okay, so I call this DNS source routing, and how do we do it? You know, I'm not going to do the live demo, but I'll show you it here. What I have here is an echo service built into NAMDI. Now, names in DNS servers are usually, you know, they're preloaded into some kind of database. Just like on web servers, we used to only have static data. But then someone realized, oh, wow, I could dynamically generate the contents of this web page as the content, as the queries came in. So what I have here is you can go ahead and you can look up 10-0.1.55, and if you look up its name server, wow, that's going to be 10.0.1.55. Shocking. Any query name that comes under the 10.0.1.55 domain is going to apparently only be hosted by something at 10.0.1.55. That's going to be the one name server. And of course, if that happens to be on the internal network and is some piece of malware, oh well. The easy fix. Fine. We'll just disable what's called recursion on the external interfaces. Meaning, you know, you can go ahead and go to a name server and say, hey, I don't know the answer. Can you tell me? If the machine on the external, on you know, this name server, if it knows it already, sure. It'll go ahead and do a bunch of lookups for you. But if, I mean, no, excuse me, if it knows it, it'll just tell you out of its local database. But you can say, don't go out to the hierarchy. Don't look up a bunch of information. Don't investigate everything. Just say no. I don't want to know. I don't want you to go and look up stuff for random people from the internet. This is actually a decent policy. You know, most corporate name servers should not be going to Google or porn sites or whatever to look up IP addresses. Is that enough? Can we just shut off externally hosted recursion? Turns out no. Because there are lots of IPs, there are lots of services that will be on internal addresses that will still go ahead and request lots of DNS lookups. Mail servers. I tell a mail server to do something, it has to go ahead and do an MX lookup. It has to talk to the DNS network, and it has to find out where does the mail go. Oh, well, you know, I'm not going to be sending mail on my external SMTP servers to external hosts. That's not a problem. Okay. I connect to an SSH daemon. It goes ahead and says, oh, look, this IP address. Why don't I go ahead and look up the name associated with this IP address? So it's called a pointer lookup. SSHD does it. Apache does it. Your IDSs do this. So I go ahead and I scan, you know, a good chunk of the internet. And would you believe that like tens of thousands of hosts were very curious who was sending all this DNS traffic? Now, how would I know this? Well, because I control my own reverse DNS. When you ask the DNS hierarchy, who is Dan's IP address? I get to answer, which means I get to know who's investigating my traffic. So, forensics people, when you look up an IP address to see whose it is, hi, I see you. How are you doing? Now, just because a lookup starts as a pointer request to do this reverse lookup doesn't mean it stays one. Now, this gets incredibly wonky, and I am going to struggle to explain it. So I am sorry if it's a little difficult to understand. So this is the next generation attack. Pointer lookups need to come... And I'm sorry with the guy with the camera that I wander around a bit. I'll try to stand still. So check the... How you doing, man? So check this out. Pointer lookups. I go ahead and I ask the hierarchy, hey, ARPA hierarchy, because that's where these things are hosted. Who has this IP address? And it, you know, goes to this, you know, gives me a hop and gives me a hop. And eventually, it comes to me. Now, as I said earlier, I could say, oh, you're looking for that IP address. Well, that's, you know... foo.docsparrow.com. I can say that. I can also say, you know, I don't know, but why don't you ask, you know, bar.docsparrow.com at some other IP, and then it, you know, runs off there. But I can also do this. Why don't you ask ozymandns.com? His IP address is 3421. Now, I can say 3421, but who the hell am I to talk about ozymandns? I'm not ozymandns. I'm docsparrow.com. The DNS server can't trust me to tell them where ozymandns.com is. So even though a request started out as pointer, now in order to fulfill the pointer lookup, it has to do an address lookup on ozymandns.com. And that's where things get interesting, because now it has to start passing a name out to ozymandns.com. It has to go back to the hierarchy, back to wherever ozymandns.com, and says, hey, where's
Hello, startup SSH session. .ozymandns.com. Can you tell me where that is?
That's an arbitrary payload delivered to an arbitrary IP address, which, by the way, can be in an arbitrary network, including the internal network at 10.0.1.5.5. So, your IDS can actually be used to trigger internal communications with arbitrary content. How do I get responses back? Well, my piece of malware inside your network picks up this traffic. Can you tell me where hello.ssh.ozymandns.com is? And the answer can be no. But why don't you ask, SSH is right here, .docsparra.com. This can't be trusted. This is Ozymandns. Who does he know who DocSparra is? So this response, this second A-level lookup, has to go all the way back to DocSparra.com, who can go all the way back and forth and back and forth. So, trying to clarify here, the IDS can cause the DNS server to make a request to some outside server who can send data back to the inside, who can go back and ping back and forth all the dang-dong day. There you go. So, moral of the story, seriously, watch your DNS traffic. As an aside, for the love of God, please stop logging just the DNS, the reverse name in DNS. You know, when you get traffic from an IP address, log the IP address, because I control my reverse. And I can go ahead and say, oh, yeah, you want to know the name for 64.81.64.164? Oh, yeah, that's 127.0.0.1. And that's what goes in your logs with Apache and SSHD, like today. So, when you're writing code, please log the actual IP address. More risks of open recursion. You know, we're actually getting a little bit short on time, but check this out.
Hello. May I please interrupt you a little bit?
Go ahead.
You said that 127.0.0.1.
Hang on, let me go back to the slide you're referring to.
In fact, that's not true, because the servers usually check that forward record again, and so they see this is a forged record, a forged PTR, and they don't write it into the log.
How would it know it's a forged PTR record? I go ahead and I look up a pointer, and this is the name I get back. If yes. I do the get name by host, why doesn't this work?
Of course, and then you check the daemon checks, which...
Are you saying that it will go ahead and look up 127.0.0.1 and make sure it goes back to 64.81.64.164?
Of course.
Okay, servers that do that are actually safe. Not all daemons do that. A fair number don't.
Nearly all don't do that.
Really?
In fact, Apache does it.
All right. I'll stop mentioning Apache in that. I'm pretty sure SSHD doesn't, though. Because there's a decent number of situations where reverse doesn't necessarily... You know, we'll chat about this later, but he's probably right. I'll flat out say that. How about that? Single bit data transfer. So here's a challenge. Can two people talk using a DNS server to each other without being able to talk to each other directly? In other words, can two clients communicate using just a DNS server? Well, not easily and not at all fast, but yeah. And I'm just going to show you how it works and illustrate it as I do it. So here's what's happening. We are going to take hello CCC and split it into its constituent bits. We are going to do lookups against the ever nice DNS server at 4221. All of those names, 9, 6, 8, 6, whatever, all of these names are now in the DNS cache at 4221. Now, the only ones that are in the DNS cache are the bits that are set to 1. The bits that are set to 0 are not in the cache. This is what's called externally visible.
H-E-L-L-O-C-C-C.
Thank you. Never let it be said I did not create the least efficient data transfer mechanism of all time. And it turns out, by the way, and I was going to give a demo of this, but it turns out you can actually, you know, DNS servers are used for more than just like those individual bits. Like, people are actually using DNS servers to do useful things. But you can still pick up the bit of information about whether that address was picked up or not. And because of what's called the TTL value, you can actually pick up when, say, Google was looked up, Google's mail server was looked up, you know, someone's, like, you know, CNN, whatever. Whatever you want to know, you can go ahead and go to a name server and say, hey, have you looked up this record lately? Because I would like to know. There's a very nice paper called by a guy by named Louis Grangia called Snooping the Cache for Fun and Profit. And it'll go ahead and it'll show all sorts of interesting stunts you can do. And if I get time, I'll give you a demo of doing this like at an internet scale. Oh, this is kind of neat. I'll go ahead and tell you guys about this. So anyone use like RSS readers? The bloggers love them. God, that's nice to see. No, long story short, you know, lots of people like automated readers to go to blogs and tell them if there's anything new. And there are so many of these readers that are constantly polling every hour that it's actually causing lots and lots of traffic. Well, I'm thinking, hey, I'm doing DNS stuff right now. Why don't we have a DNS lookup that returns the last time, you know, date and time that the that some web page was updated? And I was originally going to put it in a text record, this last modified field. It would say, last modified this time. And if it's, you know, sooner than you got, you go and get the record again. Go and get the page again. But then I realized times can be represented in Unix as 32-bit integers. DNS, I think it's really good at moving 32-bit integers. I don't know why. Oh yeah. DNS moves IP addresses all the time. And IPs are 32-bit integers. So what you can do is you can represent the last time some web page was updated as an IP address. The code is trivial. You do a get host by name on the argument, and you cast it as time. And you take a look, and you get back a time that's at the point this time CNN was updated. Pretty simple. And it's about as efficient as it could possibly be. It's, you know, kind of like my penance for that single bit crap. Domain cast. Is it possible to demonstrate large files quickly using nothing but DNS? This is much cooler to show as the demo.
Okay.
Hi. So here's the deal. DNS servers, they kind of have a way of bandwidth limiting you by default. But don't worry, we have millions and millions of them. So if we distribute our mass amounts of traffic across those millions and millions of them, hey, guess what? We get much, much higher data rates. What does it look like? Well, approximately like this. We're going to grab a 800 kilobyte file using 76,000 name servers. Okay, it's a little bit broken. I'm still working on my massive like reconstruction, but it looks a little like this. That is a heck of a lot faster than that's supposed to be. Right now, we're only getting about 20 kilobytes a second. Why? Because NetDNS is fast. It's not that fast. It's got its limitations. But we're getting about 20 kilobytes a second now with, I think it's probably going to be 10 to 20% packet loss. Our server list. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of servers. Okay, I'm going to show you this. How did we get these servers? This tool is much faster. So, yeah, straight up C is really, really fast. Oh, by the way, the most reliable way to actually detect if a DNS server is at a given IP address is to look up an address it already has. Now, lots and lots of DNS servers are out there, and they're all hosting different names. But, you know, they all have one name they are all aware of. And that name, my friends, that name is localhost. So you basically ask it to do a lookup on 127.001, and they all know, hey, that's local. That's me. So one of the things I was talking about, and I should mention, so the domain cast idea is not only do you distribute data, do you grab data off of, 76,000 servers, but they all have caches. So they all, you have 76,000 caches to distribute your data across. So if you went ahead and you had 80 records cached in 20K, about 20 kilobytes a server, you can get Nopix, and it's just 35,000 servers. That's no problem. There's 2 million out there. So basically what you would do is you'd have a list of where each of the blocks are, and you'd have some redundancy, and you'd distribute it out. And I originally had this huge, complex way of distributing it, just giving a list of who has what turned out to be a lot easier. But what if streams? This is fun. This is my favorite demo of here. Pre-cached hop lists. You can't really, if you have everything pre-cached, you can't adapt to streaming data. Can we possibly transmit a live stream of data using DNS? The answer is, yeah. And we don't even need to use a funky server. I'm going to do this with Bind. So check this out. We're going to do. So we're going to separate. Oh, this thing's totally. No, it's not muted. What we've done is we've taken live radio, that's radio out in California right now, we've turned it into 880 millisecond chunks of audio encoded using the Speaks codec, and we've put them in a loop inside of Bind. We use dynamic update, it's well supported by Bind, and we actually not only do we update the loop, but every time we add a new 880 millisecond chunk, we add another record that says, here is where the latest chunk is. So what do we end up with? We end up with really crappy sounding radio that's going over DNS. I didn't expect this to actually be useful. I swear, I was just doing this as a stunt. But then I remembered DNS caches, which means everyone in this room could use the CCC DNS server to download the stream and listen to it. The server would only go out to California once, and everyone here would listen to the live stream off the cache. I didn't think this would actually be useful. This is actually so useful. One of the plans I have is to port this chunking back to HTTP. So you'd have an MP3, because, let's have some capacity here. You take maybe 4 seconds of MP3 audio, you'd encode it into an individual file, and then lots and lots of people could share that file off the same squid daemon. And I'm going to write that at some point. So that's what I've had to show you. At least till tomorrow when I beat MD5 like a dead horse. All right, conclusions. One, DNS is globally deployed. You use it. Just accept it. Two, as the rest of IP has gotten more and more filtered, people have been way too terrified to touch DNS, and for good reason. But DNS offers some services like proxying, like massive routing, that are just unmatched anywhere else in the entire internet at the moment. Three, the connectivity that DNS offers can offer a whole range of services, from VPNs to silent but addressable Trojan horses to an unexpectedly useful caching audio system. Four, don't go shutting off your name servers. Your network will die and you'll get fired. But perhaps you can start monitoring your traffic. So that's what I've got. And I'm open for questions. Anyone? Yes, all slides are at, oh, here. You'll have to forgive me, I don't actually have an N key anymore. Can you guys read that? www.doxpara.com. Go ahead.
Short question.
Oh, it's the guy with the great question. Cool.
Yes, of course. You said you break a lot of if you shut down DNS or something. I totally agree with that. But your first tunneling thing based in on TXT records. And what would you expect? What would break up if you deny TXT records?
Ah, yes. Everyone wants to do this. They want to say, oh, you're using text records. We'll just filter text records. Okay, I will go ahead and I actually did this. I implemented it using MX records. I would download an MX record and the names in the MXs would have the payload. Then people say, oh, we'll limit the MX records. I say, okay, I'll go ahead and I'll put them in IP addresses. The bottom line is DNS will always allow you to get some information downstream.
But if you do it in A records or something, that would be time slower.
It'd be a lot slower, but I can still go ahead and reasonably get about, what, how many DNS records can you get down in a single A? Say 8, 10, that's going to be 40 bytes. So 40 instead of 220. Okay, it's a lot slower. It's still not going to stop me. That's the point. There's no way inside of a single packet to know this is absolutely illegitimate. Now, one of the things I've worked on involves testing the entropy level of packets because large packets with high entropy are probably going to be tunneling something.
You're right on that.